Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Sales is King. This is Dan Sixsmith. Glad to be with you. And we've got another great guest, Chris Orlob, who many of you know is a B2B sales influencer. He was at Gong for many years, and he is now, he's laughing now that I called him an influencer, but he's someone that a lot of us look up to and one of the top kind of sales people out there in terms of knowledge. And I'm really happy to have you. Chris, welcome. Glad to have you on the Sales is King podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. It's always funny when people call me like an influencer or whatever, because I guess that's not the same thing as a celebrity, but I'm pretty sure I'd be like the world's most boring celebrity of all time. And I try to convince my wife that I'm like this cool guy in the industry that I work in. She doesn't care.
You're the Kylie Jenner of B2B sales. So love it. Well, let's go back a ways. Let's start early on. When did you, tell us about when you first thought about getting into sales and what that was like and what your first sales job was like?
It's kind of weird because during my teenage years, my aspirations in life were to be the world's best drummer. And I looked the part. I had, big pierced ears and long hair and all this kind of stuff. And a few years ago, I went back home, right, to my parents' house where my old drum set was. And I saw this piece of paper sitting on the wall that said goals. And it was goals I had written when I was like 15 or 16 years old. And most of them were what you would expect from somebody with those ambitions. Like, I wanted to tour with my band through California and become the world's greatest drummer and all that kind of stuff. But I found it interesting that a couple of my goals were learn sales, learn marketing, study psychology, and become an entrepreneur. And I don't remember having those thoughts at like 15 or 16. But I think where they came from is my dad was never, very economically successful, but he did spend most of his adult life in sales, kind of like odd sales jobs, like call centers. But he taught me the value of sales and being able to earn based on the value you create rather than like hourly or salary or whatever the case was. We lived at the end of a fairway on a golf course, and all of these golfers would slice it and hit golf balls into our backyard, and we'd collect them because we had a fence, and I would sell them back to golfers, right? So it was like 25 cents a golf ball. So this is like my first time, ever selling anything. I was probably like 6 or 7 years old. And then later in life, like when I was like 16, 17, this must have been 18 or 19, because I think I was in college at the time. I was like a broke college student, and I didn't like that. And at the same time, my dreams of being a drummer were dying for a number of reasons, which I'm happy to share if you want to get into that. I can't imagine you do, though. And I just kind of like made this vow that I was going to do well for myself economically. And sales was my path to getting started in doing that.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, sometimes it takes some sort of something that happens in your life to kind of drive you to it. And certainly, having no money and, wanting to be successful is, one of those. So what was your, after your kind of entrepreneurial golf ball experience, what was your kind of first official selling job?
Yeah. So I had a couple unofficial ones, which led to the official one. So these were all during college days.
Yeah.
I was selling coupon books door to doors in like college dorms. It was like 10 bucks or 30 bucks a piece. I would get a $10 commission. Then I sold home security systems over the phone, Vivint, if you're familiar. And before I was done with college, I worked at Sears, like selling like fridges and stuff. My first like real like professional selling job was when I landed a job at InsideSales.com back in 2012 or 13 as an SDR. And I did that for, a few years. I climbed through the ranks pretty quickly to account executive, then regional sales manager. And I got that first taste of making good money, right? Money that I had never experienced before, nor had the rest of my family. And I was hooked.
I love it. And then so as you were starting out, How did you do? And how did you pick up, you know, you were comfortable, obviously, in the selling arena, but, you know, was it then that you started to try and learn more about sales and selling? Because I know you're a voracious reader. You've probably read more books on sales than anyone I know. But is that when you first got started kind of becoming a student of selling?
Yeah, I was reading voraciously like that since the very beginning of my SaaS career. Like I was very addicted to reading sales books and watching, you know, YouTube videos and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it both helped me. It helped me tremendously in the long term. In some ways, it hurt me in the short term, though, because I had so many different like conflicting approaches and strategies and tactics all bouncing through my head. And my manager pulled me aside one day and he goes, I can see your mind darting while you're in the middle of a sales call and what you need to do to get to the next level. Because I was good at the time, but I was kind of inconsistent, right? Sometimes it was like, it was like feast or famine for me. Mm-hmm. He goes, the way for you to get to the next level, which is consistency, is you've got to develop a system that you can follow that takes bits and pieces from each of these other, you know, methodologies that you've learned from that works for you. And that's what I did. And before I knew it, I had reached more consistent, repeatable, sustainable sales success. And that conversation really helped. I think about that kind of coaching interaction I had with him quite often.
Yeah, that sounded like it was a pivotal kind of moment for you. And you know, it's true. You even today, right, you start to look at a lot of these different books and approaches and methodologies, and sometimes you just get a little, it's just too much, you know? And then I guess, like you said, over time, you're able to kind of synthesize this and then start to, you know, put it into work and start to maybe put different things in different buckets and what have you. So then Gong, right? The kind of crowning achievement. Tell us how you got there. And then maybe, you know, a couple of stories that you haven't told about back in the day.
Yeah. So Gong came as a result of me failing at my first entrepreneurial venture. Mm. So after InsideSales.com, I had socked away enough money to basically take care of me and my family for a couple of years and just live off of, you know, savings.
That's great.
And I was desperate.
How old were you then at that point?
I'm embarrassed to say I was either 23 or 24. Mm.
Okay, that's not embarrassing.
Now, when I joined Gong, I think I was like 25 or so. But, you know, I was like this kid who, you know, I had my first child. And my wife and I had gotten married recently. And she's a saint. I was like, hey, can I quit my six-figure job and start a company? And her one response, and she still tells me this to my day, to this day, anytime I want to do something crazy, like start P Club. Just goes, as long as we're not living on the street, you can do whatever you want with your career.
Wow.
And so I quit my job shortly after and recruited my co-founder, who's also my co-founder for P Club, like very smart technologist and just operations guy. And we tried to build Gong. This was before I even knew about Gong. I had talked to like an analyst from Gartner or something like that while I was, you know, still at InsideSales.com. And I asked them, I'm like, hey, there's this entire industry called speech analytics. It's like call center, old school Gong like call center software for call centers, but not B2B. And I asked this guy, I'm like, why does this not exist for B2B sales? And he goes, I don't know. And that was enough for me. I was like, okay, this is what we're building.
Opportunity. Yeah.
And so we bootstrapped for like 18 months. Didn't work out ultimately for a number of reasons. The main one is we didn't know what the hell we're doing. Like truly, we were, you know, basically just trying to start a business. And when we closed up shop, I told them all to go check out Gong. They'll, you know, they'll probably be the market leader. They had raised money at that point. And I still have the LinkedIn message. Amit Bendov, the CEO, reaches out to me and he's like, hey, I heard you closed up shop. I hope it's not true, but if it is, can we talk about working together? And I was very excited about that because I had been secretly scheming how I was going to approach him. And he was the one who approached me. So now I got to play it coy a little bit. And I jumped at the chance. I was super excited. The company was doing $178,000 in annual revenue at the time. I actually talked to, I don't know if he is, Steve Richards still over at
Sure he is.
So yeah. I talked to Steve too, about potentially joining ExecVision, and I talked to another competitor, and ultimately I chose Gong and had a lot of fun for about 6 years after that.
Amazing. And then how long did the entrepreneurial venture go for?
That was only about 18 months. Yeah, my hair is the color it is because of that 18
And you're still married, which is good, you know?
So sometimes I'm surprised. My wife puts up with a lot. Like I said, she's a saint.
I love it. Oh, that's so great. So so you basically added a few zeros to Gong. Talk about a couple of the stories there, or a couple of the big deals or the first deal or anything that might be interesting.
Well, my first couple of years at Gong, I was actually in a marketing capacity, which was new to me, but I wanted to try my hand at it because I had always been fascinated by marketing. And so Amit let me run product marketing for a couple of years. And our big success during, that time was turning this data that we were analyzing with Gong anonymously and publishing it and saying, this is what the best reps do according to data from our platform. It went really viral. So that helped us get that initial velocity. And of course, it wasn't just me. Like, I was leading that marketing campaign, but we had a data science team behind it. Amit and Udi, who are, CEO and CMO, very involved in that entire project. The guy who does not get enough credit for Gong's insane revenue growth, though, is this guy named Jameson Young, who's still there. He was like first VP of sales. He joined at like 500 grand in ARR. And I learned so much about deals and selling him. Very sharp guy, right? Like he would think very critically about our sales process, right? Who was the right buyer persona to start with? And then go to him. It wasn't just about multi-threading. It was who do you talk to first, second, and third, and how do you put the right blend of people together on the buyer side to get a deal done? That had never occurred to me before. I just thought multi-threading in general, no matter who it is, what was the right thing. And he was like, no, if you pull in the wrong buyers at the wrong time, you're going to get boxed in. So learned a lot from him. Eventually, I ended up reporting to the chief revenue officer at Gong a couple of years ago or later, Ryan Longfield, and just learned an insane amount about people leadership. If you've ever met Ryan or you know who he is, he just exudes leadership and like authentic charisma, and you just kind of want to follow the guy into battle. So there's, I was really fortunate to learn leadership and sales and all these things from some of the top practitioners in the world.
That's great. And then so you led a team there eventually of sales folks, and did you pick up some of your kind of leadership management style from him?
A lot of it, both from him and Jameson. So I ran a team of about 30 reps and three frontline managers my last 3 or so years while I was at Gong. And it was the same thing, just lots of coaching from both of those guys, and I owe them a lot.
That's great. And now, so you leave Gong, and then what happens after that?
Well, there's a lot of stories that led up to that. So I'll go one by one, and I'll keep each one short. My last 6 months at Gong, I took on a head of multi-product job. So I was responsible for transitioning the company from a single product company to multi-product, which was really hard. it was really way harder than I thought it was going to be. And I was convincing myself it was the right move for me, but I think secretly I hated it so much so that in President's Club that year, right in Punta Mita, Mexico, I was rushed to the hospital midnight one night thinking I was having a heart attack. And it turned out to just be an insane panic attack, right? Like very panic attack because I was bottling up all these, emotions. As a side note, I took 6 weeks off of work around that time, like had a sabbatical. And I had a panic attack almost every day for a 6-week period. It was wild. I'm happy to report I haven't had one since that period of time. And, you know, that's a different lesson for a different day.
Mm. Mm.
But that whole kind of just dark period led me to getting back to my roots and what I truly wanted out of life, right? Like, there was a period of time, this is kind of embarrassing to say, but like during that whole episode, I thought I was dying. And so I was confronting a lot of, you know, thoughts about reality and that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And I convinced myself, I'm like, I have to go be an entrepreneur. That's like what I truly love to do. And so that eventually led us to starting P Club around that time. It was like July or August, probably August 2022.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, sometimes it just all hits you, you know, you're running hard, you're running hard. And then, you know, you're not even thinking. And then suddenly, you know, you stop for a second and it all kind of falls in on you. So, so amazing, right? And then so P Club now, talk a little bit about that. Super great content. How many people, how many customers? It looks like it's doing super, super well.
Yeah. So P Club is essentially an online education platform. Where we get to find the most amazing course authors in technology sales that are an expert at their given topic, like calling or multi-threading or whatever. And we get them to do a course with us, and we publish it inside this learning platform. We have two different platforms. We have one for consumers, and we have one for businesses. And on the consumer side, which is where the company really started, we've got, you know, thousands upon thousands, I think, probably somewhere around 10,000 learners within our platform. And then the business side, we just started closing B2B deals probably 9 months ago or so. And we're approaching 100 B2B customers now. And
wow. That part
of our business is growing really fast and just having a lot of fun, right? Like there is such an appetite for sales training that's far more specific than what's typically out there, right? Most sales courses are like... Yeah. How to sell good 101. And they're just too broad,
right.
You know, mile wide and inch deep. And the way we think of skills is deconstructing sales into all of its component parts and component skills and creating an individual course for every single one of those skills, at the beginner level, intermediate level, and advanced level. And like I said, we sell to individuals and businesses and have fun doing it.
No, that's great. I love it. As I told you, I'm a customer of yours. I love a lot of the modules. And I think it's just so necessary because the game of sales, particularly in the arena we're in, has gotten difficult, right? Super nuanced. There's a lot of, it's almost like a golf. So I'm thinking like, it's like a golf swing, you know, there's all these different things to remember, you know, do I have my hands in the right way? Is my shoulder in? Where am I lining up? You know, and it's like, have I multi-threaded? Am I, you know, do I have the right decision makers and my discovery and all that good stuff? So I think the timing is so good. So let's use this to kind of transition into B2B sales in general. What are you seeing out there? I mean, the, you know, everything we see from all the buyer surveys are, you know, sellers aren't adding value. They want 100%, you know, virtual online experience without sellers. They spend less time with sellers. Even when we see a great piece of selling these days, we're like, wow, you know, he did such a great job or she did such a great job. What are you seeing out there?
I think there's a number of things. One is we have to recognize that market conditions and selling environments typically change faster than most salespeople update their skills to meet those new demands. Right? So in 2021 and before that, you could get away with a certain skill set. In 2024, the same skill set that worked in 2021 is not going to cut it today. It's new and different skills. One example of that is if you sell to businesses, today you probably need to at least speak the language of the CFO a little bit because they're approving most deals now, whether you talk to them or not. You never had to do that in 2021 or before. Signal-based selling is a big thing. Right. That wasn't even a term a few years ago. And now, like, the best prospectors are signal-based prospectors. And it's creating and modernizing your skills. A lot of salespeople have the same kind of skill set that worked in 2021 and maybe haven't updated it for a while. Another one And I don't have a solution to this yet. I've been trying to think of how do I teach a PCLub course to do this, but it's really hard. Most sellers don't have enough business acumen, right? So you talk about creating value for your buyer during the sales cycle. Well, a prerequisite for doing that is having enough business acumen to have a valuable conversation. And how do you teach business acumen? I don't know. I've been thinking about it for months. It's a really hard one to crack. So that's one I see, because like business acumen is what I would call a threshold skill. And what I mean by that is it is a skill that makes all of your other sales skills more valuable. You can be really great at discovery, but if you improve your business acumen, you automatically get even better at discovery because you know what questions to ask next. If you're great at prospecting, like email copywriting, and then you improve your business acumen, well, your email copy just got even more tight because you're speaking from a foundation of deep business acumen. So that's a huge gap that I see right now.
Yeah, it's really tricky because like for some people, business acumen just comes from their past and their different jobs and the different roles and kind of what they've learned and maybe the different positions they were in. You know, for example, maybe we need to hire more executives in kind of senior selling roles because, you know, they're talking to executives. So, yeah, I think that's really, that is definitely a good one. But yeah, we see that like, you know, when you, there are more executives than ever before in these deals and you have to have business acumen and come across and speak like an executive to an executive, right? And there's, it's not necessarily an easy thing to teach. And it's almost like the whole universe that all those other components feed off of. So yeah, I'll be curious to see how that goes. So let's talk about, you know, you talk about so many different key things. Is there any top one or two skills that, you know, sellers should be focusing on to really get better in 2024?
Well, it's going to sound kind of generic, but I don't think it is, and I'll explain. I think discovery is probably the most important, because the way I think about sales skills is it's like a wheel, and at the hub of the wheel is discovery, and everything else is a spoke. And so demos are a skill, cold email copywriting is a skill, all these other things are skills. But you can't really access them very well if you're not good at discovery. And I think like a lot of people listening are probably like, oh, tell me something I don't know, right? Like get good at discovery. You and every other sales leader says that. But most salespeople think they're good at discovery and they're not. And it's because the way they define discovery is find a need and fill it. And so all they do is ask some, you know, surface level questions. They get surface level answers from the buyer. And then they present a solution. That's not what I'm talking about. What I am talking about is peeling back and understanding the need behind the need, which is a difficult skill to execute, and having a root cause analysis conversation, which creates value for the buyer, and exploring the ramifications and impact of a potential of a challenge your buyer's having, so that they can think about the problem more clearly and prioritize it accordingly, right? That's what I mean by discovery. But saying, so just saying like, what motivated you to show up to this call today, and them telling you and being done, that's not what I'm talking about. So I think like, I would call it advanced, deeper level discovery is probably one of the most valuable things you can invest in.
Yeah. And really understanding if there is a problem for you to solve, number one, right? And is it a problem that they really care about? You know, because oftentimes we, you know, we'll uncover a couple of quote unquote pains, and then we're, you know, running into the PowerPoint and demo. And then all of a sudden these deals are, you know, dragging on forever.
Right? Well, I like to convince, I like to get my buyers to convince me that they do have a problem, and not as like some cheesy tactic where I'm trying to like manipulate them. It's as transparent as it gets. I'll even say like, look, the way you're sharing this with me makes it feel like this is kind of lukewarm. And by the time we're done with this Zoom meeting, you're going to forget about it. And am I right in sensing that with you? Or do you actually care about this? And this is the thing we should talk about. Mm-hmm. And one of two things will generally happen. They'll say, no, I don't really care about this. or they will say, no, you misread me. And here's why this is important. But I think so many salespeople, like especially those within the first 5 years of their career, think they can convince their buyer that they have a problem.
That's selling.
Yeah. Right?
We're selling, just, you know?
There is a time and place for, you know, what the challenger guys and gals call commercial education and teaching them about a problem they may not know about. But in general, if you find yourself chasing and trying to convince your buyer that they have a problem, it's probably not a good deal to be personal.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, sometimes we hear in discovery that the sellers feel like it's too one-sided, or, you know, they're getting uncomfortable. How do you make it more of a conversation? Obviously, you got to do the homework, right? So the discovery can become part validation, right, of some of your research. But what are some of the ways to make it a good conversation versus an interrogation?
I think it's like in between every main question that you ask, you stop and do one of a handful of, you either summarize what you heard or you offer an insight of your own before going on to your next question, right? So summaries, you say, let me see if I got this right. And you paraphrase what they said in like 20 seconds. And you see, then you say, did I get that right? That buys you time. That prevents you from overstepping your welcome. And it's like great WD-40 for a discovery call. It makes buyers willing to, you know, want to have more or do more discovery with you. And then another one is just offering insights, right? And this goes back to the business acumen, because I'm sure people are asking, well, how do you offer insights? I can't tell you. You need to have enough business acumen to be able to do that and domain acumen to be able to do that within your space. But if you ask a question, your buyer answers, and then your next response is some sort of, oh, your situation reminds me of, you know, one of our other customers. Here's what they were dealing with. And that's how your conversation is flowing. Those tend to go very well. Now, the other thing is, how can you make your discovery calls valuable for your customers in the sense that you're helping them crystallize their thoughts? So here's an example. When we sell P Club to businesses, we don't call our first call a discovery call because that's a sales term. We call it a skill analysis. And so VP of enablement, VP of sales will come to a call with us and we'll say, we have two goals in this meeting. And it's to get clear on number one, what are the skill gaps you're seeing in your organization? And then number two, what are the positive outcomes that you would achieve if you improve those skill gaps? And if we do those two things, it's going to lead to a successful second meeting. And we consistently get feedback from our customers that our discovery calls are valuable because they've never been asked those questions and they've never been forced to like crystallize their thinking on like, what are the concrete skill gaps? And what would happen if we closed those skill gaps? And of course, we're offering our own insight throughout what we're seeing in the market and what have you. But that entire dynamic is more valuable for the buyer than it is for us. It's still very valuable for us. Don't get me wrong. I'm a sales guy through and through, and I want to close deals. I'm not in this for purely selfless reasons. But most discovery, just when you think of the word discovery, it's so seller oriented. It's you know, just extracting information that you need to hit your MedPick criteria or whatever. Nothing against MedPick, by the way. I actually like MedPick. But usually in most businesses, there's some way you can reposition your discovery process to be more buyer centric. Right. So
for us, I love that analysis.
Yeah.
No, I love that, you know, and it's like calling discovery is like saying, okay, now we're going to close this deal. You know, we're going into the closing phase where, you know, you sign.
You can only say that if you sell to sales leaders and you have a rapport with them. At that point, it's just a joke, though. You're just joking about
I think it's super important. So let's talk about, and so before we jump on that, so how do sellers get better at this? They've got to do, obviously PClub can help them, but what else do you recommend? How do they improve in this skill to really, really get good?
Well, I think there's, if you think about the skill acquisition process, there's a few components, right? The first one is diagnose your skill gaps. Mm-hmm. The second one is learn, which is where PClub sits today. The mm-hmm. next one is practice. The final one is do, or not the final mm-hmm. one, but almost the final one is do. And then finally, mm-hmm. you've got to reinforce it to turn it into a habit. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about those five steps, there are things you need to do for each of them. So if you're trying to diagnose your skills, well, you might want to go have a conversation with your manager and just say, hey, can I spend 30 minutes thought bouncing with you about where I should focus my improvement the most, right? So if you have a manager or even a peer that you trust, that's probably one great way to do it. But you got to start mm-hmm. by diagnosing what skill that if I improved would have the biggest return on my investment in improving mm-hmm. that skill. Mm-hmm. That's one. Mm-hmm. Two is learn. Right? You need instruction. Mm-hmm. That can be done on PClub. You can read books, whatever. And then you need to go practice it before you put it into real execution. I used to do the most cheesy practice things ever. I liked to role play when I was in sales, even though it felt weird. I used to take my phone when I was like, I don't know, 23 or something like that, and like record pitches so I could practice it. And then mm-hmm. I would like review it. So probably not the answer you were looking for, but like if you mm-hmm. think about skill building in those five boxes, so mm-hmm. diagnose, learn, practice, do, and reinforce, that'll give you guideposts to rapidly accelerate mm-hmm. your skill acquisition.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, when you think about a professional athlete or a baseball player, right? They don't just run onto the field and start playing. Right, they're in the batting cage. They're taking swings. They're working out. So the sales game is the same. I mean, we've got to be prepared. And I think role playing is certainly, or recording your own pitches is certainly something that I think is really important. So this gets me to kind of the subject of coaching. It just seems like many organizations, right? So they go and they do these skills and maybe they work with peers, but are they getting enough coaching? And do you, number one, so in your travels, do you see that this is something that might be lacking for sellers today? And if so, should they go outside of their organization potentially to get coached so that they can continuously improve?
Yeah, there's two things I hate to hear when it comes to the topic of coaching. The first thing I hate to hear is that managers aren't coaching, which unfortunately mm-hmm. is the status quo, right? That's their mm-hmm. probably mm-hmm. most important aspect of their job. That's the first thing I hate to hear. But the second thing I hate to hear is reps complaining that they're not getting coaching. And the reason I hate to hear that is like, okay, so is your destiny in somebody's hands and you're just okay with that? And you're, if you've ever heard of the concept of secondary payoffs, it's basically you're getting something from a situation that is not great and it makes you addicted to that situation. And usually a secondary payoff is you get the right to complain and you get attention from other people and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. or it just makes you feel better that you're not progressing. And complaining about not getting enough coaching or training or whatever from your company mm-hmm. to me is the definition of a secondary payoff. The reps mm-hmm. complaining, oh, I'm never, I'm not going to hit my number or make enough money because my manager is not coaching me. Well, take it into your own hands then. The whole reason any of us get into sales is so that we have more control over our destiny. So right. It's kind of two conflicting things, right? On the one hand, I hate to hear that managers aren't coaching. On the other hand, I hate to hear when reps complain about that. But yes, like if I were to zoom out, I think the status quo is managers do a lot of deal coaching, which is valuable and has its place, but not a lot of skill coaching.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something. But I agree with you. It's like really every year you should put together a personal development budget. You know, like if your company is not taking care of you, you've got to figure it out. It's almost the equivalent of saying, I don't have enough leads and marketing's not getting me leads. That's why my numbers are down, you know, and that doesn't fly either. So let's talk about a few other things in terms of, you know, what's going on today. Face-to-face meetings. What do you think? Are you seeing more of that? And is that going to be more helpful to closing in the current environment?
I think so. It's hard to say. I don't think I've detected a pattern yet, but I will say this. P-Club's biggest customer, who spends several hundreds of thousands of dollars per year with us, I never met anybody until after the deal was closed. And so it was all done remotely over Zoom. So in I don't want to say you don't need to meet face to face, but the world is the world definitely is more tolerant to remote selling than it used to be. It used to be unheard of to be able to close a $300,000 deal all through Zoom. That said, I think you can put yourself at an advantage where most sellers want to be remote and they're too lazy to get on a plane.
And
if you're the one who's willing to jump on a plane and go meet somebody face-to-face, of course you're going to make an impression. All of the customers, the P-Club customers I've met in person are our healthiest customers, right? This this is coming after we close the deal, but there's something to that, right? When I go on site with them and talk to their sales team and meet the executives or whatever, those customers aren't going anywhere. There's no way they're going to churn. They're so healthy. It's because I jumped on a jet.
Yeah. And it's, you know, in today's environment, it's another differentiator. And sometimes it's just, you know, it's a toss up. It's an intangible and it might get you over the line. Someone got on a plane and came and sat down and shook my hand and wanted the business, you know, and it's got the old fashioned relationship development. Last point before we go into a little bit of personal questions in terms of your kind of background and what have you, AI. We've had folks on here all over the map with AI. some folks saying it's garbage at scale. Others saying it's too early in terms of the technology. And others saying if you're on the sidelines, you're making a big mistake. What's your general opinion on AI in sales, for sales, and anything you've used that's been a game changer for you?
So this is, I don't know if I would call this a prediction because this is kind of like short term, right? This is like a 6 month prediction, which doesn't really count, right? That's just not that far. I don't think AI, like the first question that comes to people's mind with AI in sales is it going to replace jobs?
That's
I do think it's going to replace the inbound SDR. I think it's going to augment the outbound SDR. I think it's going to augment the account executive. But inbound SDRs, like I already want to implement some sort of ChatGPT thing in my business for inbound leads because that job is algorithmic. It's do they meet the qualification criteria? If so, book the meeting. And if they haven't booked the meeting, follow up with them every couple of days until they do.
Right.
People are flawed. Right. They'll forget. Leads will fall through the cracks. I would rather have them go hunting valuable accounts and have some response thing, you know, ChatGPT response thing responding to inbound leads and just packing our account executive's calendar because it doesn't take a lot of skill. Outbound prospecting takes a tremendous amount of skill and insight. And that's why I don't think AI is really going to touch them, at least in terms of replacing them. I think it's going to augment them, but, but inbound. I'll put it this way. If and when we get to hiring an inbound SDR for Gong or for P Club rather, I think we're probably all aligned internally that we should just have ChatGPT do it, right? My CTO is an AI guy. That's where his head's going to want to go because we want to save money as a company. And why am I going to pay somebody $60,000 or $80,000 a year to respond to our leads when I can probably get it for a couple?
Yeah.
Love That's it. My take.
Yeah. Well, you know, to be continued, we have to see, but there's so many, know, I was talking to a friend of mine that's, you know, in the space, and she just got a PhD in AI. And she was just talking about just all of the companies that are sprouting up and then disappearing in, you know, 7-8 months. So you just don't know where to place your chips at this point. You know, the VCs are basically saying they know that 1 out of every 10 of their investments is going to pay off. So it's just super tricky right now, but very exciting to say the least, right? So let's talk about you a little bit. When you look back, mentors or folks that kind of helped you along the way, I think you've already referred to some, but you know, who are some of those people?
Yeah, the people I mentioned are the big ones. Amit Bendov is somebody I would highlight there too, right? CEO of Gong. Mm-hmm. He really mm-hmm. took me under his wing in a way that was just incredibly generous during my time over there. And my other mentors are digital people who I've never met before, right? Taking online mm-hmm. courses, reading a bunch of books. Sometimes I hear younger people complain that they can't find a mentor. And mm-hmm. while it's ideal that you have a mentor in real life, you've also got the library and Amazon to go buy books and courses. Mm-hmm. And you can learn from some of these amazing people through materials that they put out. And there's no excuse not to.
Mm-hmm. And then who are some of your favorite kind of social media personalities, or who do you like to follow? Whether it's LinkedIn, Instagram, or anything of that sort, or do you play in that space?
I don't really. Yeah, even though I'm one of them.
Yeah.
Maybe that's okay. Why.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Interesting.
I kind of have some strong opinions on social media, though, and I think that's mm-hmm. why. Like,
yeah,
this is just me. I don't ask other people to buy it, but yeah. I insist on being a producer of social media rather than a consumer of it. Mm-hmm. If I wasn't producing stuff on social media, I wouldn't be on it. I wouldn't have mm-hmm. LinkedIn, wouldn't have, I mean, I'd probably have yeah. LinkedIn, I guess.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have Instagram, wouldn't have Facebook, none of this stuff. It's all, I just have it because it's a good marketing channel for my business. But
right. Right.
There are a couple people, like there's a guy named Alex Hormozy that I think is mm-hmm. interesting, even though he's a little too into showing off his muscles. I don't know what.
I know what you're talking about.
You know, yeah. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
His books are really good, but I'm like, dude, put a shirt on. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't
know. Well, anything goes, man. You know? Yeah. Yeah, I'm kind of all over it, but it's interesting, you know, just getting people's take. How about outside the workplace? What are your kind of fun things to do? What are some of your hobbies?
I still play the drums, just not as hardcore as I used to.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
I aspire to get into surfing, although I haven't done it yet. And most my life can probably be summed up in three categories. It's be healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Spend enough time with my family and my kids and yeah. build people. And that's it, right? Like yeah, I have yeah. friends and I have a little bit of a social life, but I mm-hmm. sacrifice a lot of that for those, you know, top three things because you can only do so many things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's me. I don't ask other people to do it, but I work a lot. I spend a lot of time with my mm-hmm. you know, wife and kids, particularly on the weekends. Mm-hmm. I try mm-hmm. to work out at least a couple times a week. I don't always follow that. That's about it.
Oh, it's so damn hard, isn't it? You know, yeah. It's just, I'd have to sleep at the gym, I think, just so I can, you know, yeah. get up and the drive and the whole bit. And you got to pack your bag the night before and all of that good stuff. Mm-hmm. Last question I usually ask everyone is, how do you define success? I think you may have just told me, but how do you define success?
I like, do you know who Earl Nightingale is?
Yeah, I feel like he wrote a book that I should have read.
Very like, you know, kind of old school personal development, like from like mm-hmm. the, must have been like 30s or 40s or 50s mm-hmm. or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But his definition of success is probably my favorite. And he says, success is the progressive realization of a worthy goal. Meaning if you have a well-defined goal and you're progressing mm-hmm. toward it, you can consider yourself successful. And mm-hmm. that's probably been my favorite definition, right? At any given time, do I have a goal that I'm excited about? That's one. And am I moving toward it? That's two. And if those two mm-hmm. things are true, then I can, you know, rest easy at night knowing that I'm quote unquote mm-hmm. successful.
Love it. Awesome. Well, Chris, this was fantastic. So glad that you could join us. As I said, love your content. Big fan. I know a lot of folks that I talk to follow you, and they love your content, and really appreciate everything you put out there. And just want to wish you continued success. I'm really happy that you're in a great place. You're in your entrepreneurial zone right now, and you're putting out great content. And I want to really see P Club take off. So let's stay in touch. Hopefully you can come back, and we'll see how AI is taking over the world, and we'll have another conversation.
All right. Appreciate it, Dan.
Thanks for coming. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you soon on Sales is King.